Hello, my name's Ron Pattinson. I'm, if you believe some people, one of the world's leading beer historians. You can read my blog at Shut Up About Barclay Perkins. It's full of beer history rubbish. And I live in Amsterdam, and I'm totally obsessed with the history of beer.
Welcome to Wine and Dine. My name is Lynn Creelo Chamberlain, host. You're listening to iWine Radio. Oh, we have a fun conversation here with Mr. Ron Pattinson, who is joining us from his home in Amsterdam. He is the author of a brand new book called The Home Brewer's Guide to Vintage Beer. But get this, rediscovered recipes for classic brews dating from 1800 to 1965. Oh my gosh, so very interesting. A lot of beer type styles I've never even heard of before. Ron, thank you so very much for your time today on Wine and Dine. And we do talk about beers every once in a while, especially when there's something great out here like this to talk about. So you are a member of the British Guild of Beer Writers, and you're author of the blog Shut Up About Barclay Perkins. And
yes, that's me, yeah.
And beeradvocate.com calls on you because you are such a good beer historian. But I'm curious, why are you living in Amsterdam? It's none of my business, but I'm just curious.
Yeah, basically because, well, there's a couple of reasons. One, I'm married to a German woman, and Amsterdam's about halfway between Britain and Germany.
Okay.
And also because I didn't want to move back to Britain when I stopped living in the States, so I moved to Holland instead and got stuck here.
Oh, wow. So you used to live in the United States. Where in the United States?
I lived in New York for 18 months in 85 to 87.
Oh, my gosh. And were you writing about beer back then even?
No, not back then. Back then I was already interested in drinking beer, but well, it's funny because I was with a bunch of other British people there, and we often used to go and drink in the Manhattan Brewing Company, which is where Gary Oliver started out, and I remember meeting him there and talking to him right back in the mid-1980s.
Why does the history of beer fascinate you so much?
It comes from looking at old beer labels and the mirrors that you have in pubs back in Britain, where they have these old advertising mirrors that have all these exotic brewery names and exotic types of sounding beer. And I've always wondered about these things. And when I found out that actually a lot of the brewing records had been preserved and you could really find out what were these beers were like, I was very excited. I'd always assumed I'd never be able to learn this stuff.
Do you make beer at home yourself?
Not at the moment. I have done in the past. I first brewed a long time ago. This was when I was probably about 16, so back in 1973, something like that. So a really long time ago. And then I brewed here in Holland for a while and gave up because of my, I haven't got room. And I don't want to annoy my family too much with horrible smells in the kitchen.
For some people, they might say it's not that horrible.
My kids would disagree.
There are so many names that it occurs to me, and beer is not my expertise at all. So I want to ask you, a lot of these names of beers, are they proprietary names that refer back to like the inventor of the recipe or the company, like Truman Runner or Whitbread SSS or Younger XP, Russell's LDA?
Okay, you've got lots of things in there. The first one is the name of the brewery that the beer came from. So,
okay.
I mean, I've looked at the brewing records of breweries, and so I'll give the name of the brewery. And then what you tend to find is that then you've got the what are the brew house names of the beers, which aren't necessarily the names the beers were sold under. What you find a lot of them, like SSS, the reason why you've got that and why it's not called Triple Stout isn't so much because of writing in the brewing record, it's because it's what was put on the barrel. So they'd chalk or stencil something on the end of the barrel to show what sort of beer was in it.
Okay.
Now, you wouldn't want to write Triple Stout. It's complicated. SSS is much more simple. And so they had all these sorts of abbreviations. Truman Runner, I mean, runner, that means that's the running porter. So that's the porter that's meant to be sold when it's young. I would guess that when that went out, it would actually have just an R on the barrel end. XP, was that another one you said?
Yes.
That's, I think that's an IPA. The X probably stands for export, and the P for pale ale.
Oh, would be my guess. Wow. Okay, how about these that are called, that have an X on them, like Noakes X or Tetley XX?
Oh, well, that's an X. Normally, when it's an X, that's X ales, so they're mild ales, usually. Sometimes X's are used for other styles, but generally, that's what was used for mild ales. And the number of X's just tells you how strong it is. So,
okay.
Depending on the period. So, if we say take 1832, because I know what strength the top one there is, the Truman's 4X, a beer I absolutely adore and wish I could get the original version of again that Pretty Things brewed. If you start from X to 4X, single X would be about 1060, 1065, double X, probably about 1075, 3X, 1085, and 4X, 1100. So basically you have something that went like 6, 7, 8.5, 10% alcohol in terms of beers.
Oh, okay. I was wondering if you were referring to alcohol. And
it was a general, it was just a way of the brewery letting you know what sort of strength the beer was, so that if you had the single one, then that's just the ordinary strength, and you could see if it was a stronger one or not.
Okay. And how about this Usher OSA?
OSA, yeah. Well, that's probably, could be two, one of two things, and it might have been actually both. It's either old Scotch ale or old strong ale. You find with the stronger beers that were brewed in Scotland, they were normally called strong ale, but if they were sold in England, they were generally called Scotch ale.
Oh, whoa. And are all the beers that you focus on in the Home Brewer's Guide to Vintage Beer all from United Kingdom?
No. There are a couple of beers at the end of the book which are from continental Europe.
Okay.
That it's slightly different because in the British section, all of the beers, all of the recipes are taken from original brewing recipes, apart from one Guinness one. Whereas in the final section where you've got a couple of extinct German beer styles and a couple of an old version of a current one, these are taken from books where there were recipes that described how to make the beers rather than original brewing records. But I mean, I've got some fun things in there. Breuhan, which is the style of beer I'd most like to taste. So it's this stuff that was, for a couple of hundred years, it was the most common beer style in North Germany and then disappeared without a trace, became virtually completely forgotten. So I'd really like to try one of those. I've still not managed to persuade a brewery to make one.
Mm.
And then you've got an old version of Salvator, Salvator being the original Doppelbock. But if you go back to the 19th century, it was quite different from nowadays in that it was only about just over, it wasn't very far fermented, which means that quite a small proportion of the sugars were turned into alcohol.
Okay.
So it meant you'd got this beer that had got lots and lots of malt in it.
Oh, wow.
But because it wasn't fermented very far out, because you're only looking at like 55% apparent attenuation, that it's much weaker than you'd expect for that strength, but it'd have loads and loads of body and loads of sugars left in it. It's a beer I've got a project to try and brew, but it's been very difficult because trying to get that high of finishing gravity, so to have it ferment out so little, is actually quite tricky.
It almost sounds like it's a meal. It's a liquid meal instead of...
Yeah, well, that's what it was used as. I mean, if you look at the history of Salvator, it was the beer that they drank during Lent. The monks in a certain monastery in Munich. So it was designed to be a meal as well, and that's probably why it had so many sugars left in it, because you wanted to get lots of nourishment out of it. You didn't particularly want to get totally drunk.
Right. Wow.
And if you look at modern Salvator, it's completely different. It's got much lower gravity. It's fermented out much further. Completely different beer, really, and I wanted to show out why, you know. It used to be something quite different.
Ron, one last question here. Is there no such thing as a Pilsner beer in the time period that you're recording in the Home Brewer's Guide to Vintage Beer?
Yes, there are. And you've reminded me, I probably should have put some in, because I do actually have some recipes for Pilsners from that period that were brewed in Britain. Because one of the breweries, I've looked at the records a lot, Barclay Perkins, They were one of the first breweries in Britain to really have a successful lager brewery. Various people had tried in the 19th century, and only a couple ever lasted very long. But in the 20s, Barclay Perkins built a lager brewery in their premises in South London, and that lasted a long while, and there's pilsners in there. So I could actually have done a pilsner recipe. I didn't think of that.
Mm. But as you say here, really just based on what you have listed here, the majority of the popularity is more for ales than pilsner. I would think, especially coming from a European palate. Well, we'd like to thank Ron Pattinson so very much for joining us today, author of The Home Brewer's Guide to Vintage Beer, Rediscovered Recipes for Classic Brews Dating from 1800 to 1965. Thank you so much for your time, Ron.
No problem. This is a pleasure.
We will have links up for you to learn more. And you're listening to Wine and Dine.
You're listening to iWine Radio.